Carl Jung said, "Awaken and shine your light for others to follow. The privilege of a lifetime is to become who you truly are." This is an invitation to move differently in the world, to operate from a place of deep knowing and alignment. I'm Adrienne McDonald, and welcome to the Source Code Podcast. Let's dive in. Hello, beautiful humans, and welcome back, or welcome if it's your first time. Grab your coffee or your tea, and let's get into what the Muse has for us today. We're having another episode in my Conversations series. I have a lot of interesting friends, we have a lot of interesting conversations, and I am inviting you to listen into some of those. Today's subject is around imposter syndrome. It comes up a lot in my work. It came up a lot when I was in corporate America. And so I invited on my friend, Dr. Hope Dugan, and it was a great conversation. So let's go listen in. Welcome back, everyone. I have a fantastic guest today. He's a good friend of mine. When I was thinking about the conversation I wanted to have in March, I thought, well, it's Women's History Month, and one of the subjects that comes up in conversation, has come up in conversation in my conversations over the past 20 years, is imposter syndrome. And I invited Dr. Hope Dugan on to have that conversation with me. Now, she is a consultant and a coach with over 27 years of experience helping leaders across industries regain control of over their limiting beliefs. Her passion is empowering women to recognize their worth and gain the skills they need to be unapologetically bold. And she does that very, very well. And I will also add my own anecdote here that I think one of the most interesting things about you is you have this like really strong depth in education, but also this equally strong in depth experience in theater and creative people managing and being a creative person. And I think the marriage of that is, first of all, it's unusual to find. Second of all, it's super cool. So anyway, welcome. And I'm so happy that you're here having this conversation with me.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm always up for a good conversation. And I find that this topic comes up so much in my work, regardless of if I'm working with men or women or in what environment.
So I think that's something important to know. I've worked with both men and women too, and I think imposter syndrome is a universal problem. Like it doesn't matter what gender you are. But I do think that it manifests differently for women versus men. And but I think that it probably would behoove us to, why don't you give me your definition of imposter syndrome? Because when I'm talking about a subject, I like to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
So the phrase was initially coined as imposter phenomena, and it was by two female psychologists, Suzanne Imes and Pauline Klein. No, that's not it. Clance, Pauline Clance. And they coined this phrase in 1978. And what was interesting is that they both came from childhoods, which they felt like caused them to have a persistent kind of nagging voice in their heads telling them that they just weren't good enough, despite being above average achievers. So in one case, the woman grew up in a home where she was the youngest of six siblings, and she was always told she was too sensitive and things like that. So she felt like by the comparison, she never was able to live up to her other siblings, though she went on to be quite successful in pretty much every indicator you could talk about with success. In the other, she grew up in a home where she was told that, you know, the good, better, best, and that, you know, she's so great and she's so smart and she needs to keep pushing herself. And so she always felt like she had a yardstick that was so high to live up to that she couldn't. And as they went out and began working with clients, they started to see that this was a somewhat ubiquitous phenomenon, hence why they named it. And really, at the heart of it, imposter syndrome is just this sort of deep down feeling that you are not good enough, that your achievements were due to some kind of fluke or possibly even fraud, and that someday someone is going to find you out. And what I've found is that almost everybody has bouts of imposter syndrome. Like when you get a new job, or maybe you discover you're the oldest person on your team, or the youngest person on your team, or the only woman on your team, or the only person of color. But some people just have this pervasive sense and it persists their entire life. So I think kind of that overarching, what is imposter phenomena or imposter syndrome, is just this basic kind of inner voice that just says that you're not good enough and you're not going to be able to live up to your potential.
You know, it's interesting that because I don't think when I'm thinking back of some of the leadership development training that I've had, I don't think that the part about the childhood is usually brought into the conversation during like talks about this. And which is one of the problems I think is in leadership. Basic leadership development in corporate America right now is the fact that it's like, oh, well, you know, you have your home life and it's over here and this is work and it's the work-life balance BS. But you can't divorce yourself from your childhood. You're like, if you've not resolved your crap from your childhood, you're bringing that to work. And I think that people underestimate how that can hold them back, and how much it's driving behavior in the workplace. I'm looking at you, toxic work environment right now. But I think that it's interesting because when I've certainly experienced imposter syndrome in over the years in different jobs that I've had. And I felt it in a different way after I left corporate and started my own business. Like that was a whole different level of imposter syndrome. And even now, sometimes it rears its head. Not as much anymore, but like in the beginning, it was really, really bad. So I think that there's, I think in your book, which I'll put a link to in the show notes, which is a wonderful, it's wonderful because it's a experiential workbook, so you can actually work through your issues, but it also gives you a lot of great information. You talk about the cycle of imposter syndrome, and I was looking at that and I was like, wow, yeah, I see that in myself. I've done that. I've done that. And you give some really great tips of, okay, here's the cycle, and like, here's how you can stop the roller coaster before you keep going, right? So I was wondering, I when I was doing the research for this episode, some of the stuff that came up of people have the most, you know, here's what people search for when they search for the imposter syndrome. And I had never done that before. And all the stuff that I've done, I've never actually researched that particular topic. And I was a little surprised that people were inquiring, like, is this a mental condition? Can it be cured? The amount of trying to associate it with anxiety and autism and ADHD, and that kind of surprised me. Do when your experience in talking with people, does that come up a lot in conversation?
It does, because I think that the downside of high awareness is that the term imposter syndrome has kind of fallen into one of those buzzwords. And like you said, it's not clearly understood or defined. It is not actually a term that you're going to find in the DSM. You can't be diagnosed with imposter syndrome. But imposter syndrome falls under an umbrella of things called limiting beliefs. And so while it is not a diagnosis, it is a real thing. And it's a real thing with some pretty significant consequences. Pretty much, if you are ever in the position of feeling like the other, so I mentioned kind of earlier being the one-off on your team or group, that leads to a lot of self-reflection because we are kind of designed to compare to others. So when you see that you are very different from someone else, sometimes we think, well, then that difference must be a bad thing. There's a pretty significant correlate now. Again, this was first recognized in 1978, and we've come a long way since then. So what they have discovered, if you take a look at particularly high school students with anxiety and depression, there is a frequent component of that imposter syndrome. But in high school students, it tends to then lead to, on an extreme case, not with everyone, like suicidal ideation. So it is a very serious thing, or it can be. In terms of ADHD, that was something that I was surprised about too when I was researching for the book. There was some pretty significant research and correlation with ADHD and imposter syndrome. And I didn't recognize that as something that I naturally would have done the research on. But again, I think particularly what I saw with ADHD, and I have several people in my life that are very close to me that deal with ADHD from garden variety to pretty significant. And they know that they are smart, they know that they are capable, but then they get into the cycle of ADHD and then they struggle to succeed, and succeed in this case being measured success. So, like on an academic test, on meeting a deadline, those kind of things. And then that kind of spirals them back into that, as you talked about, that cycle of imposter syndrome, where you get the brand new project and you're super excited about it. And then as things pull you away from what your initial idea of success was going to look like for that project, you sort of go through all of these feelings that end up leading you to think, why did I ever try and do this? I should never have thought that I had the ability to do this. And you just kind of spiral.
I really like the cycle, so I'm going to walk through the cycle because I immediately was drawn to that when I was going through the book because I was so recognizing some of my own behaviors, but also because I do have the ADHD as well, and how, like, my whole thing was just powering through, like, but I needed a really significant amount of high pressure. So when I look back on my life, the jobs that I gravitated towards were extremely chaotic, high pressure environments, and I did very well in those because my childhood was very chaotic, so that was normal to me, and that's how I performed best, right? So the first element in the cycle is excitement and anticipation, the brand new endeavor. And I was like, yeah, like you get really hyped up about an opportunity, right? And then procrastination, over preparation, and anxiety. And procrastination has been, like, I have always been a big procrastinator. So I could definitely see that, which of course leads to the anxiety, which I think that's now that when I look at the cycle, I was like, okay, this is why people are Googling these things together. They're searching these things together. The next is conclusion of the project, brief sense of relief followed by a sense of letdown. Or as I like to call it, the beat down, the self beat down, because it's like, oh, you should have done this faster. You should have done this better. Why did you wait till the last minute? And then the reflection, it was just luck. Totally have done that. That was a fluke. That was a fluke. That was used to be one of my, or I would minimize it. It was nothing. Anybody could have done that. It was nothing. And then doubt, anxiety, depression, feeling like a fraud, which just fed into the it was nothing. Oh, and then, and I've seen, and I think this is more of a woman thing than it is a man, where we will, oh, well, you know, it was a whole team effort. It was a team effort, and minimize the role that you had in it and spread it out to the team. And I've done that as well.
I think that's a really good point. And I do see that. I see that in myself too. And part of it comes from a healthy and genuine desire to ensure that your team gets the recognition they deserve.
Absolutely.
But when it shifts over to it was the team, my contribution was minimal, that's when you start shifting over into that imposter syndrome. And one of the things is imposter syndrome is most notably correlated with really high achieving women. That's kind of the stereotype of imposter syndrome. And part of that is just this feeling like, you know, I don't have any special skills or gifts. This was just, you know, I rose through the ranks. Maybe you'll give yourself, I worked hard. But then when you arrive there, you feel like everyone must have, at a bare minimum, your skill set. And so instead of recognizing, like, while it was a team effort, had it not been for my leadership, my vision, my persistence, tenacity, whatever it was that was your secret sauce, it maybe wouldn't have turned out that way. And I think when you get to that spiral of that feelings of fake or that it wasn't really me or that there was nothing really special about it, that's kind of a great opportunity for you to like have the flood of feelings. Have the little mental chatter, but then take a breath and say, okay, I recognize this. This is my own inner voice just nattering away in there. And this is not the truth. The truth is, I led that team to do some pretty remarkable work. And fortunately, I had great team members. But take that moment for yourself to recognize your unique and important contribution to making it happen.
So I think that one of the most common, and I always hear this on, especially like in women in tech panels, that this situation comes up about, well, I didn't apply for that job because I wasn't qualified. And this goes back to, and this was quoted in one of my, with the, when I was in corporate, this book was like pushed a lot, and I got so sick of hearing it, which was the Lean In book by Sheryl Sandberg. And I never recommended that book, and I never probably will, other than to look at it and with a through the lens of if you can find something useful, take it, and then leave the rest, because I don't believe in operating in life that way. But that's a rabbit hole. But one of the study that they were that gets quoted a lot was a, I think it was a study done by HP about that if a woman did not meet all of the qualifications on the job description, they were much less likely to apply for the position. And this was really surprising to me because this was one of the things that I did not have when throughout my career. For whatever reason, that message never occurred to me in the head. In fact, most amusingly so, the last corporate job I had was the job description was literally created for me. The CIO wanted to hire me. They created a position for me. They put a job description together. They gave me the job description. I looked down, I'm like, this is like, I don't have half these things in the requirements area. So if there was nothing else that sort of solidified that that was a little bit of bullshit in applying. And but I and I and but that was but I did recognize that in a lot of other people because I've had big teams. I've told people, hey, go apply for this job, and they're like, ah, you know, if it was one of my guys, they'd be all over it. If it was a woman, there would be a hesitation. I'm like, what, why are you hesitating? It's like, well, this says I should be able to do X right here. And I'm not, and sometimes it would be not even that it would be like, I'm not so good at that, or I'm not sure I can do that. And then there was a later study done for and it was written up in the Harvard Business Review, where a journalist had done a sort of a self-reporting type of
Type
study,
of
so it
study.
wasn't stringent. And she said that it was more that there was about equal with men and women of, well, I'm not really sure that I can do all those things, so I'm not going to apply for it. And what her hypothesis was the people didn't really understand the hiring process, and it sort of put a spotlight on that of, yeah, these are the qualifications, but we in general understand that you probably are not going to meet all of those, and therefore, but women were trended higher on the fear of failure than men did, because there have been some studies, although I couldn't find them. I was looking for them before we got on the call, that but she had referenced in the article that women's mistakes are remembered longer than men's. And I thought that was an interesting comment, because I reflected on that and I was like, well, that might be because at least in tech, there are less women. So if you do mess up, it's much more like, oh, there's much more attention on it. So, random thoughts on that?
I think that that is absolutely true. So, in my work, I've tended to work with a lot of leaders in education, and people think of education as being a female-dominated group. And if we're talking about teachers, that is the case. But if you're talking about people in leadership, that is still not the case, especially if you look at district office positions and superintendents. But I also work with women in technology and women across lots of other fields. And one of the things that brings someone to want to talk to me would be that they feel that they are stuck, which usually means that they feel like they've outgrown their job. So they're no longer happy in the job that they are doing, but they're not sure exactly where they want to go next. And we spend an enormous amount of time unpacking what you just discussed. So whether it's an actual job description that's in front of them and they will go say, I don't have this one thing. I'm always like, well, but you do have all of these other things. So if you're interested in it, apply. Because the worst they can say is no. If you never apply, you don't even get the chance. But that fear of that being reinforced, I applied for the job and then I didn't even get an interview. And for almost everyone that I've worked with, then that hits a spiral moment of that whole imposter syndrome. What was I thinking to even apply? I knew I wasn't qualified for that, and it spirals out of control really quickly. So that is very much a thing. One woman that I worked with, and we had just a really great moment. She was someone that performed at a very high level and a consistently very high level, but she hadn't risen through the ranks to the job that she really wanted. And she used that as a continuing reinforcement about why she wasn't good enough. But when we really were sitting and talking one day, finally hit on it. Her father had held the position that she wanted in the company at one point in time, not the same company, just that level job. And she had been comparing herself to how her father went to work, how her father talked about his job. But that was 20 years ago. The job has changed, the office has changed, remote work wasn't even a thing then. And when she said that, it just suddenly it hit me like, okay, you're comparing yourself to an ideal that doesn't actually exist anymore. And when I kind of probed that with her, she realized that she had been holding all of these feelings about what she should be doing instead of really honoring and recognizing all the great things she was doing. And we did finally push her into applying for more of those jobs, which she finally ended up getting one of them. And that set off another round of imposter syndrome. But by then, she had tools to work through it and recognize it. And that's the thing. All of us have fear and self-doubt, all of us. And it
Right.
sometimes is a perpetual thing that comes and goes throughout your life. And some of it is very situational. But being able to just take the moment to recognize, like, okay, this is not truth about myself. This is a feeling right now in the moment, and feelings are not necessarily facts. So I can have that moment, but then I need to take a deep breath and then work through some of those things for myself.
And I think that's about
That's
building your
about
toolkit.
bullshit. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I mean, that's the important, I mean, that is the work that we do, is help people build the toolkit. I mean, when I came out of corporate, but let me jump back for a second. One of the, I think the key points that you pointed out there in the story about your client was that she had this realization, because you had the realization, because all of that was subconscious in her mind. She did that was the programming that was running in the back of her head. It's very difficult to peel that apart when A, you don't have a toolkit, and B, when it's your own subconscious thoughts, which is why therapists, coaches, et cetera, exist, is because it's I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's very close to impossible to be able to parse that up out without any tool set to work from. And I think that that's why, if you are stuck or feel stuck, that going to a professional to help you parse that and build that toolkit, that's really important, because you want a professional that will actually help you build a toolkit, so that you can go, oh, okay, all right, I don't need to run back to them every single time. It's I can do this myself now, right? That's helping people move forward. One of the most, in fact, after I left corporate, one of the most important things that was ever said to me, I think it was Angelique Ruhr's. We were in a session and we were building out a roadmap for my business, and I kept hedging on my skill set. And she's like, well, what are you doing? And I said, well, I had this, and this, because I worked for a Fortune 100 company. I had oversight for business continuity and disaster recovery and service delivery for a Fortune 100 company. I had built this really good sized team. And she would bring something up, and I'm like, well, the team did blah, blah, blah. And she's like, I didn't have the mantle of the Fortune 100 company behind me. So therefore, I thought everything, all the skill sets that I had, didn't apply anymore. And that was, and it really took her going, no, like, let's, th this, you actually did these things. Just because you did them here does not mean you can't do them. You did them there doesn't mean that you can't do them here. The concept of skill set trans being able to be transferred into different industries and different walks of life seemed to also be lost on a lot of people, and I know it was for me. And I think that when we've in our conversations around different things, I think that's something that you've done exceptionally well, coming from like the world of theater and also education. And I think that's because you've come from these different worlds, you have a very unique perspective on building leadership. And the techniques that you use are very different than the stuff that I've seen in traditional leadership development type situations. So how do you tell us a little bit about how you bring that theater in? That's what I'm after here.
So, at 4 years old is when I first started in theater, and it was truly my first love. What I have found, though, is with being an artist and being a creative, your life is filled with the statistic is kind of crazy. If you're an actor, you're 98 to 99% rejection. So, what's also interesting is that people are drawn to the arts, usually, are people that are very self-reflective, they're also seekers. And because of that, they also have a lot of feelings of unworthiness. So that arts background kind of forges some of that in. But what's really great about having a creative background is that you are also raised on the concept and ideas of the magic what if. When you're an artist, there are very few boundaries or limitations around thinking. And so you can just, well, what if this was this way? For example, I have been watching a bird building a bird nest just outside the window where I'm sitting. And in my brain, to say, well, what if that bird suddenly turned into a pterodactyl? And what if while I'm sitting here doing this podcast, it's trying to get in the back door? Oh, that makes me think of this that I want to write. Oh, but what if we filmed it? And your brain just expands. And what's really amazing about that is that we are in the knowledge, I don't know, eon sub part of our society. This is information age. We have moved past that. We're now into the knowledge age. But our next and most important frontier is around being able to use our minds in a creative and innovative way. Because, as it said in Back to the Future, where we're going, there are no roads. The knowledge that we had that has allowed us to predict with a lot of success about what's going to be the next great thing and all of that, that is shifting. We are talking about quantum mechanics, quantum computing, quantum physics. We're talking about our abilities now, and the possibilities are truly limitless. So when I'm looking at working with people, there's a very finite and clearly well-defined, as you called it, toolkit that we develop. But there's also that certain part where you have to be able to use your mind creatively to think about things, to solve the problems that you didn't even know were going to be a problem, but also to apply unconventional wisdom to conventional problems. So I don't know if that's kind of what you're getting at, but
I am. I am. I think that I think when people get stuck in the cycle, I think that curiosity and creativity are the main roots out of that. And I think it's really hard to feel like you're a fraud when you're being curious and creative. Because if you're enmeshed in that deeply enough, it like the muses are talking, man. Like it's flow. And the more we can have people focused in those areas, we have less judgment in the world. We have more innovation in the world. We have more connectedness, interconnectedness of things and people. And that's why I was really excited when you were developing these different toolkits for people, because I think that this, especially with the arts background, as you're moving into these different areas and different people are working with you, it's not just the same old, like, here's what you have to do, and this is work-life balance, and lean in, and blah, 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 blah. And that's why I was really excited about some of it and during the conversations that we've had, because I feel like there's this magic that comes from that creativity. And in some of the conversations that you and I've had, you know how I feel about, okay, if you really want a strong transformation in your life, you've got the psychological component, you've got the physiological component, and there's the esoteric, metaphysical, the spiritual component. Because that's where I feel like the seeker, the creative lie is in that, because that's just part of your essence coming through. Yeah, and I feel like you have to have that if you're going to have sustainable transformation. And I also think that the more you tap into that, the more you know yourself at a deeper level, the more you know yourself at a deeper level, the less likely you're to hop on the imposter cycle.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that about curiosity. I do believe that is one of the strongest gifts that we all have. And human beings are hardwired for curiosity. But over time and a data culture, we've kind of had some of that beaten out of us. And there's a pretty significant body of research around creativity in children that if you ask a kindergartner to do something creative versus asking an adult, that it is a pretty clear exponential downward track around creativity. But curiosity, I think, is one of the single most undervalued gifts that we all have. A lot of work that I do now is helping people understand their own data. And data can be used in a very shaming way. So one of the things that we talk about is remaining unattached to outcome and remaining in curiosity. So when you are presented with some facts, whether that's data or something that's happened in your day-to-day life, taking that step back to wonder about what are the questions that you have about that? What are the other potentialities that come with that? And I think that, like you said, if you remain in curiosity, it just opens up a world where you're not thinking about I'm a fraud or I could have done this better or what's wrong with me or I don't belong here. You start thinking about the world of possibilities. And I think that is always such a healthy approach to things. I'm so glad that you mentioned that.
Yeah, it's cultivating curiosity, I think, is a very underrated, powerful transformation tool. I think it's a underrated and powerful leadership development tool, because some of the greatest leaders that I've witnessed are extremely curious people. Because again, you can't be curious and be in judgment at the same time. It just doesn't work that way. It's like, okay. And when you're curious, you're genuinely curious, it opens, it creates this space for other people to also be curious, and also fosters more open communication. Instead of going, oh, if I say this, this person's going to judge me or whatnot, which leads to just better outcomes for the team overall. And that's applicable to personal relationships as well. It's just an overarching, beautiful thing to cultivate in your life, because it improves all areas of your life.
And Chris Argus, his ladder of inference is a really great example of why this is a good thing. In the ladder of inference, something as simple as you walked into the kitchen and you said good morning to your significant other and they kind of grunted at you. And then your brain takes off at a million miles a minute and you just climb that ladder from, you know, he's always like this, or she never talks to me in the morning, she must hate me, we probably, and you just ratchet all of this up until you're at the top of your absolute ladder where you've decided all of these things and all of it was in your head. But if you have that moment of curiosity, hey babe, what's up with you? You divert all of that. And so whether that's a personal life issue or a work issue, you know, you get a phone call from your boss's boss asking you to join them on a meeting. You can ratchet through that whole ladder of inference in like 2 seconds flat, or you can take the breath and remain in curiosity. Like, huh, I wonder what that's about. Okay, that's a little weird, but okay. And, you know, sometimes being curious is going to lead you down a lot of other paths of potential. Being curious just expands. It doesn't limit.
Right. It expands. And being curious about yourself, I think that towards the beginning of the podcast, you said, like, what is true about this? Like, that's really how you get to the root of things, is being curious about what is the truth in this. And digging a little deeper, because the more you know yourself, like I said, the less rattled you're going to be by external circumstances, and unless you're going to need ex or seek out, I should say, external validation. Because really, it's like that little meme says, validation is for parking. That's it. So
That's so true.
it really is. I mean, I think everyone appreciates being valued and seen and recognized. And I'm not just, that's fantastic. But I know for myself personally, a lot of my churn was people pleasing and looking for someone else outside of me to tell me, oh, you're worthy. Because it's those two typical core human wounds of you're unworthy or you're unlovable, or a combination of two, depending on your whatever was going on in your childhood. And another the thing that came up was around perfectionism, and a lot of people that have imposter syndrome have strong desire for perfectionism. Now, I don't have that. I've got a 3-5 human design profile, which means that experimentation is my game. But what I did do was not be able to stop experimenting, and it's continuous improvement. I can do it better. I can do it better. I can do it better. It wasn't really about perfecting it as much as and getting out there. The perfected item is much of I would get obsessed with the process versus the end product, and sometimes that would not go over so well at work. But I think that curiosity is also how you combat perfectionism in some ways. So, but what do you think it tilts towards perfectionism as well?
Absolutely. I think it's the big three: people pleasing, perfectionism, imposter syndrome. I think they all are kind of enmeshed. But again, recognizing it's being able to just recognize to stop it kind of in its tracks, because perfectionism and people pleasing in and of themselves are neither negative or positive. They just are. So anything taken to an extreme, or anything that you start to do at the devaluation of yourself, those are going to be things that can be negative. Whereas if you use those, like that, I think is a great example of perfectionism that people wouldn't think about. When I was doing a lot of acting, I much, much more enjoyed the rehearsal process, because every day I liked to tinker. Well, what if I said this line this way? Well, what if I did this with my head when I said this? And I love that process. And for me, the performance process was something that I didn't enjoy as much. And that's usually really the opposite for people who are performers. You usually do all of the work to get to the thing that you want. But that is the same type of perfectionism. It's just in a more healthy expression of it, that I want it to be the best it can be. Well, what if we tried this? Or what if we tried this? But that is one of the things that I struggle with in a work environment. I want to just keep trying to make it the best it can be before I release it to the world. And sometimes, like, we got deadlines and, product launches, things that have to happen in a certain way. So at some point, you have to let that go. But people pleasing is a thing that, again, it's associated more with women, but this can be anybody. And that absolute drive for that external validation is also part of that internal monologue that you have running. There's a, and his name, help me with his last name. It's Michael. I always want to say Simon because I love the
It's
show.
Singer, Michael Singer.
Singer, who talks about the psychotic roommate in your head. And that image and way of talking about those limiting beliefs really helped me, because if you think about it, if anyone else in your life talked to you like that, you'd be like, bitch, please, like, you're crazy. But yeah, we talk to ourselves like that all the time. And so when you start to hear those people pleasing, perfectionism, imposter syndrome voices in your head, to be able to take the breath, like, okay, Where is the true in the fear? And where is the psychotic roommate in my head? And I'm going to evict you. Like, you have exactly 10 seconds left, and then bye. And I find that to be really, really helpful. And people pleasing and perfectionism also come out of your childhood stuff. It can
Oh,
be
yeah.
reinforced and validated from them, but it goes back to, again, you talked about it, the concept of being worthy. We talk about
Right.
self-esteem, self-confidence, and worthiness, but that worthiness piece, I think, for women in particular, is we can kind of work with a lot of those, but we get to a certain place in our lives or career, and that worthiness comes up. Do I deserve this? And what I love is Oprah Winfrey talked about worthiness and deserving. And she said, while you don't all deserve this, you are all worthy of this. And I think that's a really subtle change in how we think about ourselves.
Yeah.
Because if you are worthy of good things, you are worthy of trying for that job interview, you are worthy of being in the position that you are. And worth is something that we are all born with. We are all worthy. So I think those are ideas and concepts that are very tied together tightly. And I think one of them, if you can pull on one of them, that idea and concept of that I am worthy, I think that too helps undercut some of that chattering in our brains.
I truly believe that because I found that to be true in my own lived experience of the work that I've done over the past, especially over the past 10 years. And there's also a misconception that when you I have arrived, so therefore this will never be a thing for me. And I don't think anything drove that home to me more than I read Shonda Rhimes's book, A Year of Yes. And Shonda, if you don't know her, she developed Grey's Anatomy. And I read her book and it was so eye-opening. She's got this number one hit. Actually, I think she was also the developer of Scandal. And she had two, like, number one, number two on television hit shows, all these awards, and she still was hiding. She didn't like to take interviews because she just kept thinking that somebody was going to find her out. And then one, I think it was at her sister's house on Thanksgiving or something, she made a decision that she was going to start saying yes for a year to things that came up. And the book that she wrote was sort of that chronicle of that year and the transformation that she went through. And one of my favorite chapters in that book is sometimes yes is really no. Because she started saying no to things that weren't really of value in her life. And that was really saying yes to herself meant that she needed to say no to some other things and some other people in some cases. And I found that to be true is when you start really coming from a place of worthiness and owning your gifts and really being very clear in your values and operating in alignment in the world, that you will have things fall away. And that is sometimes very difficult, but also very necessary. But that was a real, like, when you were looking from the outside, she had everything. She had material success, she had accolades, she had all the things. And through that process, she just learned that A, people are going to judge you regardless. That's not about you, that's about them. Do what's like know what's important to you and know what your own value system is. Which is another thing that I think people talk about but don't think about very often. I remember the first time I did a values exercise, and it was with a coach, and I was still in corporate. I look back now and I just shake my head because my number one value was productivity. Of all things, productivity was my value. Now that shows you how enmeshed I was in corporate culture. It's like being productive, work those 80-hour weeks. And I remember even getting challenged on it. And I'm like, no, absolutely. No, this is it. And I like that doesn't even probably crack my top 25 now. But I think that that's something that people also don't think about very often. But I know that that's something that you bring into your toolkit pretty early on.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible point that you made. And I think that in some cases, our life journey and our jobs, I'll just say that, kind of take us away from our values. And what I love about being strong and knowing what your values are is it is the decision maker from which everything else flows. Wisdom is one of my values, as is kindness. And taking a look at those things when I'm making decisions. So, is this living into my values? Is this the embodiment of things that I value, or is it not? And I think having that really clear idea, because some of us have a kind of a nebulous idea of things I value. I value my friends, I value my health, I value relationships. But what does that mean? And can you get that value down into one word? And I ask people to come up with three values and then unpack.
I think that's good because it's not like so much that you can't whip them off the top of your head. And I think that's really important. And when I'm talking to someone, I actually ask them to go look up the definition of a word. It's like when we do the like some people do the word of the year, when someone tells me what I'm like, did you look up the definition? Because that like words have power. And being very like super specific and precise, A, going through that exercise means you're gonna like think about it more, you're gonna reflect more. And B, you're much more likely to remember it that way.
Yes. And I thought that was actually a really powerful idea when you told me that because I had not thought to do that. And now I love words. I've always spent a lot of time looking up words, but when you put that in direct about your value words, I was kind of blown away by that. I was like, why hadn't I thought of that before? But it is powerful because words connect us and words connect us over time, over place, over our lineage. And so it's not just the power of the word and what the meaning has become. It is the multiple meanings and the transition of that word over time that causes that really deep resonance when we choose it. So I thought that was a really great, great idea to do.
Yeah, I really like to know where the word came from because and like you said, words mean different things over time. This is not people back today like that is a new thing. That is not new. And I think it's important for people to be able to explain it if someone asks them, like, well, what does this mean to you? Because I do that a lot. It's especially in today's more divisive world. It's like, well, if someone brings a concept or something, I'll say, well, what does that mean to you? Again, that's part curiosity, but also I want to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. That way, less, arguing, more understanding. So I do think that's important. So as we're coming up on time, I'm curious to what would be like your top three tips for someone that is finding this challenging right now? They're like, okay, I hear what you're saying, but what can I do right now that maybe can help me get out of this nasty cycle? that I'm on this roller coaster and I want to get off this ride.
So I'd say my number one thing globally is to stop comparing. So we are living in a social media society where everybody puts their perfect Insta life or their perfect Facebook life, and then that's what we think their lives are like. Even if we can intellectually say, well, it can't be that perfect, we are looking at what they are performing and showing as their life. And we're comparing ourselves to that. And if you are comparing yourselves to an unattainable idea, you're never going to reach that. So the one thing that I always start with is if you hear the woulda, coulda, shouldas in your head. So, well, if I only would have done this, or I should have done this, or wow, we could have done this differently, that's a comparison. And so when you hear those things in your head, or when you are thinking, well, I'll never be as good as, that's another tip that you're comparing. And take the moment, but then talk yourself down off that ledge. Like, I'm comparing myself to something that maybe isn't even a thing. The next thing is that there's several different tools that you can use to ratchet down. So if you are catastrophizing in that moment, and that means that you are going immediately to the worst possible outcome. So going back to your boss's boss sent you an IM, hey, can you meet me in Zoom in half an hour? Instead of imagining all the horrible things that can happen, oh my God, I'm going to be fired. I know I messed up on that one thing. Stop and do some deep breathing. Humans are designed for breath work, and the sheer act of taking that breath in, holding it, and exhaling it. And I do that on a four count. So four count in, hold for four, exhale for four, pause for four. If you will do that box breathing 3 times in a row, you're going to calm yourself down, which is going to allow you the space to get inside your own head. When you are in that frantic mode like that, you can't actually think. So breathe first and then remind yourself, like, okay, what is the realm of curiosity? What could be the other reasons why? And then what is the worst thing that happens? I think that's another really great thing. So what if this is the worst thing that could possibly happen? I'm going to be okay. And always knowing that I'm going to be okay. So I think those are three things that you can do in very short amount of time without having to do a whole lot of other things. There's some really great exercises that you can do. One of them is reminding yourself of another time when you've been successful. So I am really scared about this. I just don't see how I can do this. I always make mistakes. You don't always make mistakes. Remember the time when. And that is another, if you're using words like always or never, you can catch yourself in the act of saying those. But you can also just step through. So, well, what if I lose my job? Well, that's going to suck, but I'm going to be okay. Well, what if he totally dresses me down in front of other people? Well, it's going to suck, but it's going to be okay. And I think that those things kind of combined together, that's a tip of the iceberg approach. And if you want to go deeper, there's a lot of other things that you can do that really walk through your mental processes to help you come out the other side so that you recognize that it is an imposter moment. And then you can talk yourself down off the ledge, either by thinking about prior successes or remaining curiosity about what things could be, or by just remembering that, you know what? I am worthy of happiness. I am worthy of having the job that I want. I'm worthy of living the life that I want to lead.
Yeah, having like your top 10 success list is always handy, like written out somewhere. Like, so A, when you're doing your own self-eval for performance evaluations, if that's also handy, like jot down those successes so you can record them in your performance review at the end of the year for self-eval, because your boss has probably forgotten stuff because he's got his own stuff going on or she's got her own stuff going on. But those are all really great tips, and there's so much more in your book. So again, I'm going to put that in the show notes to check out Hope's book because it's really it's great because it actually walks you through the steps of doing the things. And I will put her contact information in the show notes as well. So thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me. I enjoyed it so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love having this conversation with you today. And I think it's something that's important because we're, if you keep your secrets all buried away in the dark, then we can't do anything. But just surfacing it and like, hey, it's a thing, and most of us have it, and it's okay.
And your website is
HopeDugan.com.
hopedugan.com. Again, I'll put that in the show notes, but thank you so much. Thanks for listening. As always, I would love to hear your feedback, especially on these conversation episodes. I think they're pretty interesting, and I'm looking forward to doing more. Also, happy to connect on social media. I tend to be on IG, Threads, Facebook, and LinkedIn more than anywhere else. Remember to find beauty every day and to seek the magic in the mundane. Thank you for listening to the Source Code Podcast. If you found this episode insightful and feel moved to, please leave a review and share it out with those you believe will find it helpful. You can check out my website for more information at www.adrianmcdonald.com. And for more of my more regular musings, connect with me on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and LinkedIn. I hope you have a beautiful week.